Well, the lecture this afternoon will be one-dimensional man. One-dimensional man. What I'm going to try to do is to give you a critique of the radical's critique of technology. In other words, this isn't a self-sufficient lecture on technology as such, but a critique of their critique, pointing out where we've got to look at it even closer. But as I've done before, let me frame it with some quotations which will set the tone for the lecture. First, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Let him believe that he's always in control, though in fact it's always you who really controls. There is no subjugation so perfect as that which keeps the appearance of freedom. Secondly, Jacques Ellul. He is most enslaved when he thinks he is comfortably settled in freedom. Thirdly, Paul Goodman. In the closed room, there is only one system of values, that of the rat race itself. This is shared by everybody in the room and held in contempt by everybody in the room. Fourthly, McLuhan. Speaking about technology. Man becomes, as it were, merely the sex organs of the machine world. Fifthly, a famous quote from Mario Savio, Berkeley radical. There is a time when the operations of the machine become so odious, make you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even tacitly take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels and upon the levers and upon all the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And then one from William White, the American sociologist. I'm afraid it's the American dream that's going to have to give. Whatever its more elderly guardians think, people are growing restive with a mythology that's too distant from the way things actually are. The last one's Marcuse. Every revolution has been a betrayed revolution. If we really want to understand the counterculture, one thing that's very central and not at all just peripheral is the fact of their critique of society. Because their critique of society is at the same time a point of strength, indicating the razor sharpness of their insights, and also a point of weakness, since here most conspicuously their lack of a basis and an alternative is obvious. I'd like first to try and discuss their critique of society and then to show where their inconsistency in thought and action eventually led on inevitably to frustration and their final failure. Let's first of all see, though, that you don't really understand the counterculture without understanding the centrality of its critique of the technological society. One common mistake of looking at the counterculture is to look at comparatively isolated factors such as the generation gap or the Cold War and explain the whole counterculture in terms of a few isolated factors. Certainly these have their place, but theories like this eventually dismiss the counterculture as a reaction and never appreciate its significant action. Such critiques are good readings in social determinism with sociological mechanisms of stimulus and response, but they're actually closer to the one-dimensional mentality that the counterculture so strongly opposes. A second mistake is to try and explain the counterculture in terms of pan-cultural theories. In other words, great sweeping theories would just explain it away. And I could give several examples at this point of analysts who do this. For example, Marshall McLuhan. He explains the whole pattern of recent events in terms of a clash between the Gutenberg galaxy of the printing age and the electric era of the television age. And he claims that there are two generations caught between these two modes, and they exhibit two differing reactions. The older generation indulges in backward looking, an orgy of rear-view mirrorism. But our generation, the younger generation, feeling its crisis of identity and having no roots in the past, takes to violence as an involuntary quest for identity. And so McLuhan says the whole of the counterculture, student power, black power, is merely a quest for identity through violence. But such an explanation is desperately oversimplified and actually explains away more than it explains. Another man who does this is Toffler. Toffler, as you know, in his book The Future Shock, sees men divided not by nation, race, or ideology, but by their pace of life and their position in time. And what he believes is that many in our generation are merely those who are unable to face the adaptation required by the acceleration today and are suffering, in other words, from future shock. And he gives examples such as the hippie colony in Matala Beach in Crete. And he says, these young people, I'm quoting, and millions of others, the confused, the violent, and the apathetic, are already showing the symptoms of future shock, They're its earliest victims. Again, if you read Toffler, his tendency is to explain away far too much. Certainly you could apply this idea of future shock to very small pockets of the counterculture, but it's hardly fair as a description of the whole. A third man who does this is Jeff Nuttall. Well, unlike the other two, Nuttall is a radical, but he makes the same kind of mistake in his thesis in The Bomb Culture, his book. He speaks from the heart of the London Underground, I mean the radical underground, not the metro, and says, what has happened is that the pressure of restriction preceding nuclear suicide has precipitated a biological reflex compelling the leftist element in the young middle class to join with the delinquent element in the young working class for the reaffirmation of life by orgy and violence. What is happening is an evolutionary convulsion rather than a reformation. In other words, the last 25 years are simply a reaction to 1945. Certainly as a descriptive explanation of subcurrents like the mods and the rockers that we're looking at this morning, this is valid. But it does absolutely no justice to the greater part of the movement, nor its products, such as magazines like the New Left Review. Incidentally, it doesn't even do justice to Nuttall's own poetry, which is extremely good. The problem with all these analyses are that they include sweeping generalizations and are vastly oversimplified. They explain the whole in terms of one point, and usually they miss the significance of the whole. They try to explain it, but explain it away. But the crux of the New Left's critique is the reverse. Rather than explaining the whole in terms of one point, they try and explain the smaller points in relation to the larger whole, because this alone gives insight into the nature of the whole. In other words, the New Left has discovered that a penetrating critique of one point leads on automatically to a critique of the whole. Let's take the bomb, for instance, which Nuttall raised. Nuttall raises that claims that our generation has reacted to the bomb as an event, 1945, 25 years of counterculture. This doesn't go deeper enough. A better approach is to examine the bomb in terms of its relations to the nature of modern society. Actually, you'll see the bomb is not so important as an event, which influences particulars, but rather as an ethos or a mentality which informs the whole. So that if you study the bomb in the light of the whole of society, war comes to be seen as part of the whole lifestyle. Incidentally, this insight is often part of an integral part of the process of radicalization. Very tentative and limited criticisms suddenly and inevitably lead someone on to an involved, systematic critique of the whole society. You could probe the issue of the bomb further, for example, and examine the nature of modern warfare and its relation to technological society. For the first time in man's history, the necessity of war is stalemated by the absurdity of war. So the traditional resort to war as a solution to international problems is no longer viable in the sense of the maximum weapons, i.e. nuclear weapons. If you listen to certain people tirading against the bomb, often you can catch underneath a kind of petulant annoyance at the fact that the bomb has removed society's ultimate recourse. But actually, rather than meaning the end of war, the bomb merely forces violence further back down the levels or stratas of society. For example, it'll mean the increase in guerrilla warfare and very much increased limited wars. And violence will erupt at many more penetrating and deeper levels, such as communication and the psychology of advertising. Further issues like the means of modern warfare and looking at these various things, such as the use of propaganda, civilian involvement in war, you can really look at the whole thing and see that the modern nation is getting very close to what Marcuse calls a welfare through warfare state. In other words, it's this whole of any advanced industrial society, with its intricate web of highly complex interlocking relationships, which is the system. And the system is just a convenient all-purpose umbrella word for the political, economic, and social mechanisms of technology. Of course, it shouldn't be necessary to stress the word system in itself is not derogatory, it's only descriptive. And it can be used with connotations, good or bad, on either side. Either as an extreme witch word, the ultimate insult, the system, or as a panegyric, a good word. For example, Marshall McLuhan describes the system in the electric era as the seamless web or the global village. And to him, this only has positive and optimistic connotations, in line with his hope that the system will bring Pentecostal unity to the world, his words. But for a radical to describe the world as the system carries connotations of capitalism or fascism, and the word immediately summons up feelings of strong disapproval. For him, the system is a witch word spewed out as the ultimate insult. Now, since this is an area in which words are often strong in connotation and weak in definition, I think we'll approach it not so much through the heated rhetoric of the student radicals or even the ideological criticisms of the Marxists, but rather through more neutral critiques in the West itself. But what we'll see, even in some of these neutral critiques, is a growing consciousness that Western technological development is increasingly militating against human fulfillment. Now, as we look at these critiques, not all of them are radical by any means. But curiously, even those that are not politically radical or left often provide ammunition for the radical salvo, even if the man's premises and conclusions ultimately put him on the other side of the political spectrum. Let's begin with Max Weber, and we'll work up from Max Weber right up to some of the modern critiques. The work of Max Weber is of fundamental importance, for he was the first to define bureaucracy and relate the rise of bureaucracy to the growth of modern industrialism. For Weber, bureaucracy has three essential features. Horizontally, it's characterized by a division of labor and a specialization of roles. Vertically, he says, it's characterized by the nature of a hierarchy, from the workers to the bosses. And overall, as a complete unit, is characterized by its permanence as a structure. And this is his idea of bureaucracy. Probably it's best portrayed in the novels of Franz Kafka, especially The Castle and The Trial. Of course, Kafka's vision is much more than sociological. But the sociological absurdity certainly compounds the metaphysical absurdity he's writing about, too. Any of you have read The Castle, it's very much the domain of power and authority. Telephone exchanges produce more muddles than connections. Bureaucracy drowns in a deluge of files in triplicate and forms. And you have a stifling hierarchy which makes it quite impossible to get to the man above you. And you have countless petty little officials who work endless overtime and get nowhere. And in numerous interviews and committees are held, and all of it comes to no purpose. In The Castle, man is just reduced to being a file in the system. Whereas in The Trial, man is reduced just to being a case. And Kafka once wrote in his diary, the conveyor belt of life carries you on and on, no one knows where. And one is more of an object, a thing, than a living creature. Kafka was describing the world of the late Habsburg or Austrian Empire. But already he was seeing the deeply etched human effects of the rise of bureaucracy. The same sort of thing that's delineated by Weber. And even people today, like Hannah Arendt, they point to bureaucracy and the system of bureaucratic power as the main factor right the way around the world, which is uniting student protest, which in many other aspects is very different. It's intriguing that in the East they march and protest for things which we in the West couldn't care less about, and so on, vice versa. But one factor which unites student protest worldwide is the factor of bureaucracy. Here was the early statement of it then by Weber. From this early work, let's pass on quickly to social critics near our own times. And first of all, to various voices in the 1950s. Critical voices of the 50s. The first man we'll look at is David Riesman of Yale University. And he advances Weber's idea with his own picture of society as the lonely crowd. And this is his book. Writing in 56, Riesman was studying what he called the iron cage of Weber's latter-day capitalist bureaucracy. He noted that since morality had been reduced to morale, and parental influence had gone, usurped by peer groups, and all around us was the pervasive influence only of the media, which he called the whip of the word, society in this atmosphere had become just the lonely crowd. And the lonely crowd was characterized by polarization. On the one hand, you had the old-fashioned individualist, whom he called the inner-directed people. And on the other hand, you had the great new majority, the conformists, whom he called the other-directed, who were just conforming to society's ideals. The first group was archaic. They were looking to values that had gone. no longer valid. The second group is dangerous because they were just accepting everything that went. And he said, sadly, few people represent their own minds, which is his third way of thinking, the autonomous individuality. Here was the first expression, the lonely crowd. The same year, a second man, William H. White, took this further in The Organization Man. The Organization Man. In White's analysis, gone was the Protestant ethic, gone was the American dream, gone was even the early Weberian bureaucracy. White saw that in its place there had been the rise of a much smoother social ethic for which men were now leaving their homes, both spiritually and physically, to take the vows of the new organizational life. This was the organization man, not necessarily an executive for a recognized corporation. The organization man could just as easily be a medical student for a corporate clinic. He could be an engineer in the Boeing complex, a seminary student training for the established church hierarchy, a physics PhD aiming for a government research lab, or an apprentice with a Wall Street law firm. But none of these mattered which. But in all of them, he was the organization man. The man who believed in the group as the source of his creativity, who took the ideal of belongingness as the goal of his individuality, and who affirmed the omnicompetence of science to achieve all his social goals. And White pictures him as the, quotes, the well-rounded man, emerging through the pipeline of his education, living in his classless suburban situation. One very important facet of White's originality was the fact that he was the first to stress what he called the fatal friendliness of the system. The fatal friendliness of the system. Now, this is a point Marcuse was later to develop even more forcibly, and one that Aldous Huxley had already predicted. White wrote, "It's not the evils of organization life that puzzle him, but its very beneficence. In seeking an ethic that offers a spurious peace of mind, thus does he tyrannize himself." So he followed Huxley, and White was the first to sociologically define the caress of what Marcuse has called technological rationality. The system delivers the goods and everyone's happy. He also saw that this immediately changes the ground rules for revolutionary thinking, because the proletariat is now happy. And you'll no longer find rebels with a heroic cast necessary for revolutionary action. And White concluded, hell is no less hell for being antiseptic. In the 1984 of Big Brother, one would at least know who the enemy was. A third critic of the 50s is Paul Goodman. And Goodman's general position is well summarized in his book, Growing Up Absurd. He looked around society and arrived at the blunt conclusion, quote, man is what suits a particular type of society in a particular historical age. In other words, society is not formed to suit man who knows his mannishness, but rather man is socialized to conform and to be educated to a certain ideal of society. In fact, it is not that man is educated to conform, but that education is itself culture conforming. In the light of this, Goodman presumed that the Beats and the Angry Young Men we were looking at this morning could be described simply as inadequately socialized, and so they were growing up absurd. But then the question comes, socialized to what? To what definition? To whose definition? Whole men who are human, who know their mannishness, only come from wholly human and fulfilling environments, with real opportunities for the development of a full human aspirations. And Goodman analyzes society to see if this is currently feasible. For example, in his books, he looks at jobs, individual significance, the class structures, patriotism. And he finally concluded that it was society, not man, who was to blame, because man was being dehumanized because society was conforming him to that which is not fully human. Let me quote. Our abundant society is at present simply deficient in many of the most elementary objective opportunities and worthwhile goals that make growing up possible. Our society is lacking in enough man's work. It is lacking in honest public speech, and people are not taken seriously. It's lacking in the opportunity to be useful. It thwarts aptitude and creates stupidity. It corrupts ingenuous patriotism. It corrupts the fine arts. It shackles science. It dampens animal ardor, discourages the religious convictions of justification and vocation, and it dims the sense that there is creation. Our society has no honour and it has no community. Today that wouldn't sound very radical, but in his own days it's the first of a whole wave of new questions. Such a society, he was saying, wants men only on its own arbitrary terms. Some of you may have remembered that famous sign at Hunter College in the 50s for the debate on the Beat Generation, conform or die, which aptly satirized the choice of technological man. Goodman predicted that those who were misfits would just grow up absurd, out of joint, out of line with the mainstream of social conditioning. He said, where there now are thousands of these young men, soon there will be hundreds of thousands, for the organized system is the breeding ground of a Beat Generation. This is written out of the context of the Silent Generation. But Goodman was already relating the rise of protest to a depersonalizing system. Certainly he could debate a lot of Goodman's ideas. For instance, he has a strange stress on the fact that boys have the problem growing up and not girls. This is, in most of his books, made very curious in the light of women's lib today. But in other areas, his analysis was undoubtedly prophetic. He strikes a modern chord in his delineation of the outlines of the system. For instance, he says, society is an apparently closed room in which there's a large rat race as the dominant center of attention. Here he comes very close to the world of Sartre's No Exit, where hell is other people. The particular hellishness of the modern system is reduction of all values and even of counter-values to the level of pseudo-values. In the closed room, he said, as I started with that quote, in the closed room there is only one system of values, that of the rat race itself. This is shared by everybody in the room and held in contempt by everybody in the room. And so his analysis is this. Technology is the system was containing men so there might be values and counter-values, but really there was no more reality behind them. A fourth important social critic in the 50s is Cyril Wright Mills. Here you have a man who is radical. Mills is a Texan sociologist and a Columbia University professor who became the father of the New Left. In 1959, he published The White Collar, which was his analysis of a particular group in the States which he saw as vital because of its falsification as Marx. Marx had said the 20th century would see the workers and the bosses polarized and this would lead to revolution. But in actual fact, rather than leading to contradictions and polarizations, the 20th century had run counter to Marx's prediction, and you'd seen a collusion of the workers and the bosses. This marriage, he said, not only characterized modern America, but this particular group, the white-collar workers, because of this, cementing the two groups which should have polarized, was actually, as Mill said, more typically American than the frontier character probably ever was. Nonetheless, Mills argued, man was not rewarded deservingly, for the white-collar worker was no longer free as the American dream had originally promised. And this is where Mills comes very close to William White. He says, he is always somebody's man, the corporations, the governments, the armies. 5 years before White, in other words, Mills revealed the dilemma of the small man, the Willy Lomans of society. He said the 19th century workers had faced material hardship. But now the 20th century workers, the white-collar workers, the new little people, faced a psychological hardship. And having lost a basis for their beliefs, they were morally defenseless and politically impotent against the system. Again, the reason for this, and this is the important point in all this, was the nature of the system as their final environment. And Mills said something very reminiscent of White again, and Goodman. What must be grasped is the picture of society as a great sales room, an enormous file, an incorporated brain, a new universe of management and manipulation. That was 51. By 56, his critique was more scorching and scathing, and his indictment more stinging. That was when he wrote his book, The Power Elite. In The Power Elite, Mills analyzed the structure of American society, and was forced to conclude that the country was dominated by an economic, political, and military elite. And this power elite formed a strong trinity of immorality and irresponsibility. His first pillar was the economy. Once the American economy had been run by genuinely private enterprise, made up of small production units. But now in modern America, the situation had developed to the point where 300 corporations or so were in control, many of them with annual budgets much larger than the gross national product of many smaller nations. The second great pillar was the political machine. At one time, you had several dozen states, and the federal government was only a loose political spinal cord. But now they passed over more and more power to a strongly centralized executive. The third pillar was the military. Once you'd had the small state militia with frequent distrust towards a central command. Now the military-industrial complex of Eisenhower's depiction had become the largest feature of modern government and almost a government within a government. So Mills looked at this and he concluded, as decisions tend to become total in their consequence, the leading men in each of the three domains of power, the warlords, the corporation chieftains, the political directorate, tend to come together to form the power elite of America. So these three great institutions, he said, are central. And any remaining institutions, like families, schools, and churches, were important only as means to the higher ends which these three set, and so were forced to adapt themselves to modern life. But ultimately, it's the government, the army, and the corporations who truly controlled the system. Again with Mills, there are obvious weaknesses and omissions. Strangely, he has very little to say about the blacks, very little about the poor, and almost nothing about American involvement overseas, all of which have become issues later on. But his studies are incisive in their analysis, even if they're somewhat pamphleteering in style. Mills attacks what he calls the commanders of power unequaled in human history, and condemns them for their higher immorality, their organized irresponsibility. And in several places, his work is strangely prophetic of many of the charges that would have been leveled against America in the 60s, especially in the Vietnam involvement. He concluded, America will soon appear before the world a naked and arbitrary power. As in the name of realism, its men of decision enforce their often crackpot definitions upon world reality. He also predicted, incidentally, a very sorry level of national debate and described the time that he saw when you would see in the liberal rhetoric vagueness and in the conservative mood irrationality, and both raised to a principle. Many accuse Mills of inaccuracy and say that his descriptions are caricatures. But a careful look shows that many of them cut far too close to the bone and are far more accurate than some would like to admit. For example, in one of his books, he pokes fun in some imaginary advice to an executive. And here's his advice as he satirizes. Always speak in a rich, round voice, and do not confuse your superior with details. Execute the ceremony of forming a judgment, but delay recognizing the choice you have made so as to make the truism sound like a deeply pondered notion. Always speak to the well-blunted point. Caricature what you're supposed to be, but never become aware of it, much less amused by it, and never let your brain show to your superior. So he goes on. Much that Mills once attacked as outrageous, though, in his time, sadly is now accepted as normal. Speaking of public leadership in similar terms, Daniel Burstein regretfully said, the qualities which now commonly make a man or a woman into a nationally advertised brand are, in fact, a new category of human emptiness. And if you think that's too extreme, or Mills is too extreme, an example of how this works out in practice is provided by a memo of R.K. Price, one of Nixon's speechwriters in the 1968 election. Here's Nixon's speechwriter. We have to be very clear on this point, that the response is to the image, not to the man. It's not what's there that counts, it's what's projected. And carrying it one step further, it's not what he projects, but rather what the voter receives. It's not the man we have to change, but rather the received impression. And this impression often depends more on the medium and its use than it does on the candidate himself. A very honest, open, and cynical understanding of the situation in which we're dealing in a day of consensus politics, and certainly far more damning than anything Mills said. In fact, Mills' imaginary caricature of the selling of an executive is far less disquieting than McGuinness's description in the selling of the president. A third source of critiques, outside the 50s, is a group that is distinctly non-radical. We looked at Weber and then the 50s. Here's a group of critics that are distinctly non-radical. For this reason, it's all the more intriguing to find that even from those who are humanists and liberal and even optimists, they include material which, despite their premises, supports the radical critique. For example, Galbraith, John Kenneth Galbraith, is a liberal. But his book, The Affluent Society, is replete with famous aphorisms like, "Today we have the bland leading the bland." And the whole picture of America of the affluent society fits in comfortably with the radical charges against the inherent selfishness of capitalism. Or Galbraith's later book, The New Industrial State, has a striking outline of the techno-structure. And his call for the leadership of a scientific academic elite is based on a critique of the system that is very, very close to the radicals and actually heightens the fear of a swing towards the right, which the new left so earnestly resists. The second man is Lewis Mumford. And again, both as a scholar and a man, he'd be representative of the best type of humanism. And yet his mammoth studies are more and more forcing him to the reluctant conclusion that modern man, quote, is depersonalizing himself so effectively that he is no longer man enough to stand up to machines. Maybe the best example, though, of the non-radical optimist who betrays himself in the long run is Marshall McLuhan. Because Marshall McLuhan is a man of supreme hope whose material is often the perverse contradiction of his general thesis and his underlying cheerfulness. On the one hand, McLuhan's notion of the electric era and its convergence with Teilhard de Chardin's noosphere is nothing short of a position of extreme, supreme optimism for mankind generally. But on the other hand, a counter-argument from his evidence is seen in the light of two questions which we could ask of McLuhan. First, we could ask, what is the relation of media to men? Far from being optimistic, he ends up with a very radical answer. And secondly, can the effects of the media be contained or controlled? And again, you end up with a very negative answer. In answer to the first question, how are media related to men, McLuhan suggests four roles which every medium has in relation to man. The first two are positive and the second two are negative. The first role of media is extension. The medium takes something a man can do with a part of the whole of his body and projects them out into the world of technology. So a man can run with his feet, we produce a car, and the wheels project the foot. They're an extension of the feet, and they replace the feet. That's the first role, extension, and this is a good and positive role. The second role is exchange. Once the media have extended part of the human body, they provide a ready-made store or exchange of ability or speed or power which other men can use. So, for example, Einstein has a brain. But unless you personally can speak to Einstein, you wouldn't know what he thought. But Einstein can write it down in a book. And the book is the extension of the brain, and it provides a store of exchange. So now we can all read Einstein, although we can't listen to him. Now these first two roles, extension and exchange, are valuable and positive. But the last two roles relate to the damaging side effects of this positive advance. The third role is what he calls entrancement or exclusion. Because each new extension, such as the wheel or the book, magnifies one part of man, one sense of man, at the expense of the other senses. So there's no longer balance. So the ratios change. And as McLuhan says, when the ratios change, men change. Consequently, he says, all media work us over completely. For instance, the car is the extension of a foot. But in a car culture, you almost eventually eliminate the foot to the point where continual drivers might just as well be amputees who had no legs who invented the car to get themselves round. So in the long run, technology rebounds back on yourself. The last role, and the most damaging of all, is what he calls evolution. In other words, man once modified his machines for his own progress, but he's ultimately modified by his machines. That's where the quotation comes in I gave you. Man becomes, as it were, the sex organs of the machine world. Or again, he says, since the new information environments of technology are the direct extensions of our nervous systems, they have a much more profound relation to our human condition than the old natural environment. And quite naturally, they take over the evolutionary work that Darwin had seen in the spontaneities of biology. So the initial relationship is reversed. Once man lived in nature, but to help him have a better interplay with nature, he extended himself and made machines of whatever sort, so he could run faster, beat faster, etc., etc., etc. But now in turn, man is surrounded not by nature, but a technological environment, and he himself does not modify, but he is modified and developed. And so, McLuhan says, his very sense of himself is undermined. So you ask this first question, what's the relationship of the media to men? And you come up with a very damaging answer, although he's an optimist at the end despite it. The second troubling question is the question, can we control the effects of the media, or are they beyond control? Here, McLuhan's comments are not uniform. In fact, he gives three contradictory replies. Only once, as far as I have found in all of his books, does he hold out any real hope for a successful answer. And that's when he says, the only way of fighting the media is to have what he calls the antidote of related media like print. Which is an extraordinary remark, because the whole point of his thesis is that the cool media, television age, has made print irrelevant and has bypassed it. But just this one remark, he says, the only way to combat the influence of the manipulation of the cool media is to be the man with rationality and content, because you know the related media like print. Of course, if this remark is to be taken seriously, it runs counter to his whole basic thesis, and so we can't take it too seriously in the light of his other answers. McLuhan normally answers, though, in a different way. Usually, he strongly suggests, quote, there is no way of refusing to comply with the new sense ratios. In other words, once you've modified the media, they in turn modify us. There's no way of refusing to comply. A view which tends to leave us with a weary hopelessness. Sometimes he partially relieves the gloom by suggesting that we do have one hope, by following the artist. Because the artist, McLuhan says, is what he calls an early warning system against media fallout. In other words, the artist, with his very acute perceptions of where we are, is one step ahead of society, although he's one step behind technology. So the general culture is two steps behind, but the artist is only one step behind, so we at least know where we're going if we watch the artist. Although, of course, there's no way of stopping it, because the artist himself is one step behind. So as you look at McLuhan, if he were less excited and buoyed up by the inflated optimism of Teilhard de Chardin, you could see in McLuhan much evidence which is really extremely pessimistic. Let's come on next to the critical voice of the 60s. And here we'll just take one man, Marcuse. You remember the well-known banner carried by the Rome students in their revolution? Three great big M's, standing for Marx, Mao, and Marcuse. And this is typical of the heyday and the peak of Marcuse's popularity in the counterculture. For many people, Marcuse's writings gave a sociological depth and philosophical integrity to an American movement that otherwise was heavily majoring on action rather than theory. All Marcuse's books are a crushing argument to try and prove the necessity of revolution. For instance, in Reason and Revolution, he uses Hegel and argues that revolution is philosophically necessary. In Eros and Civilization, he uses Freud and argues that revolution is psychologically necessary. But in One Dimensional Man, supremely, he uses sociology and people like Cyril Wright Mills to argue that revolution is inevitable sociologically. We'll look at this book specifically, One Dimensional Man. In many ways, this is his least Marxist book. And the reason is that it's an answer as to why Marx failed to predict the 20th century fact that the bourgeoisie and the proletariat would not polarize but get together. The reason is, he says, we've seen a collusion between the two. And he explains this in terms of the modern technological system. Because he says the centrifugal forces which Marx foresaw have been conquered, but not by terror, rather by technology. Quote, on the dual basis of an overwhelming efficiency and an increased standard of living. So this is the one-dimensional society. It's technological, and it's marked by the fact that it contains all opposites. So you have a decline of pluralism that's genuine, a blurring of ideologies. For example, more and more in the technology, the Soviet Union and America look more and more alike in certain features, and the paralysis of criticism, because technology as a system contains it like this. This in a word, the key word, is the containment of technology. To the degree that society is able to deliver the goods, to that degree it's able to control man. So society is stable. I quote, "In the medium of technology, culture, politics, and the economy merge into an omnipresent system which swallows up or repulses all alternatives. And the result, as Marcuse sees it, is one-dimensional man, flattened out by what he calls a comfortable, smooth, reasonable, democratic unfreedom." Now, this is a grave charge. Marcuse tries to substantiate it in two areas. And he says we've got a one-dimensional society and a one-dimensional thought. Now, his section on one-dimensional thought is very, very weak. He's trying to knock empiricism and trying to claim that empiricism is a one-dimensional philosophy. But his arguments are very poor philosophically, and we'll miss them out. Actually, in real fact, the empiricist philosophers, far from being conformists, have a great record of radicalism, whereas the dialectical philosophers, whose Marcuse supports, have a very poor record and often were the first to support people like Hitler and Mussolini. But let's look at the other half. His charge that society is one-dimensional. Here Marcuse at his best. Above all, Marcuse looks at the dictatorial power of the mass media, what he calls the monolithic mentality, and here's his word, tele-newsmag speak, all run together. Television, newspapers, magazines, public speaking, but the idea all compressed together like this. Theodore White has called this the opinionated mafia. And this is what Riesman called the whip of the word. Tele-newsmag speak. Marcuse tried to analyze its effects and claims that it only builds up a totalitarian conception of truth. And I quote, "The unified functional language is irreconcilably anti-critical and anti-dialectical." In other words, he was saying, with this monolithic consensus of the media, what happens is that television takes everything and just turns it into entertainment or commodity and renders it totally innocuous. So you have that which is real art, and now it's just something that has sales value. Politics is just consensus. Religion is just the entertainment, people who have a polite attitude towards the conventions of the past. And philosophy even is just a discussion point without real cutting edge. So all these lose their critical quality and become contained by the system. He looks at other aspects of mass media, and he says, we hear these things so many times from so many areas that they create what he calls hypnotic definitions. So connotations become definitions, and critical judgment is silenced. For example, take the fate of the word free in the West or in the East, this side of the curtain or that side of the curtain. Repeat it just like this on different sides of the ideological divide, and they just mean different connotations immediately, and few people think about them now. Or take, incidentally, the differing interpretations of the equation, depending which way you look at it, insurgency or terrorism, or war of national liberation. They're all basically the same phenomena, but it just depends which side you're looking at it from. And the media tend to go like this all the time, so eventually, whichever culture you're in, you've had it defined for you. So the word hits you and it rings all the right bells, and you're just conditioned in this way, he says. He looks at other side effects of the media. For instance, he says, they stimulate the illusion of classlessness. You have the millionaire's wife, and a working class girl, both watching the television ad and aspiring to the same perfume from Paris or whatever, pretending almost that they can have the same values. In actual fact, in every other area, they're miles apart. He illustrates a lot of this with very interesting examples. For instance, he points out that in Time magazine, if you read it carefully, much of the very style of the language is uncritical. It doesn't give you time to stop and think. He shows, for instance, in Time, this is a very small point, he has lots of evidence, very rarely do you have the man first and the job second. Almost always you have the man as an appendix to the job. It's always California's Reagan, or Egypt's Sadat, or India's Indira Gandhi, or whatever. It's always the man in opposition to the job, and so on. And he analyzes this to show the constant effect of this is anti-critical and, finally, depersonalizing. And he finishes by saying this creates what he calls, quote, the happy consciousness, the belief that the real is rational and the system delivers the goods, this reflects the new conformism. He wrote this in 1964, and all that he said was loudly amplified the same year in the free speech movement. And that quotation I gave you from Mario Savio was very, very similar to all that Marcuse was saying. Standing on the steps of Sproul Plaza, you remember Mario Savio made that great speech with the words I quoted earlier. There was a time when the operations of the machine become so odious and make you so sick at heart that you just can't take part. You can't even tacitly take part. You've got to put your bodies upon the levers and upon the apparatus, and you've got to make it stop. And you've got to indicate to the people who run it, to the people who own it, that unless you're free, the machine will be prevented from working at all. And this became the great cry of the movement against a system seen as a machine which is depersonalizing man. Actually, Marcuse has admitted recently, there are very few students who really read me. And there'd be certainly even fewer in the third world for whom he speaks who ever heard of him. Yet whether or not Marcuse is right or even read, for many of the radicals of the 60s, Marcuse was the angel of the apocalypse, just as Cyril Wright Knowles was the great hero for the 50s. Let's go on then to the critical voice of the 70s. And here I'll just take one man. At this stage, it's too soon to say whose voice will be the most prominent in the 70s. Possibly it could be, for example, Noam Chomsky, who seems to be speaking with an increasing cogency. Some people point to Charles Reich, but I suspect his alternatives to the future are far too vague to be more than fashionable. Perhaps it will be some of the more thoughtful activists of the 60s, such as Stoughton Lind or Tom Hayden, who are now into the action and writing too, but are now writing with a maturity fired by their own direct experience. Could be any of these. But my own suggestion is that the 70s will be a period of increasing prominence for Jacques Ellul, incidentally spelled E-L-L-U-L. Because it's interesting that although Ellul wrote his books much earlier, for instance, The Technological Society, it was a decade before Marcuse's One-Dimensional Man. He wrote that in 54. He is only now coming to the attention of a wider English-speaking audience. Ellul was the first to use the phrase technological society. And his analysis has always been in advance. And yet to read his opponents, you'd imagine that Ellul was a severe reactionary, machinoclast as they call him. And many people just dismiss him because of this. Even Rozsák, in his book The Making of the Counterculture, admits that Ellul's books are the best global picture of technocracy in action. Although he actually charges that Ellul is outrageously pessimistic. But all this is unjust. Ellul has a very fine record as a World War II resistance fighter, and as a politician, and as a professor of law in the University of Bordeaux in France. And neither by nature nor by his convictions is he a pessimist in the slightest. Always, he says, his concern is merely to see whether things are so or not. And usually people who criticize him as being a pessimist are simply from the fact that he refuses to put the answers in his books because he feels that people slip off the hook too easily by bringing in cheap humanist answers at the end and not really looking at the problems of technology. One of the real reasons, incidentally, is the fact that Ellul is a Christian. And this is why he's so unusual. He's perhaps the only man who takes a solid view of Scripture with a few places that he is slightly liberal and slightly Barthian. He's by no means liberal in the normal sense. He's the only man who takes anywhere near a solid view of Scripture, and yet is right out in the forefront of any radical discussion and actually outdoes the radicals in their radical discussion. And many of them like to quote him in terms of where he's talking about technology, but they're usually embarrassed to go on when he speaks about his Christian faith as an answer to it. So he's a very, very interesting man. The most radical critic on technology today is a Christian, Jacques Ellul. That's why I really put him in, plus the fact that he's important. Now, Ellul does not want to compare modern society with any romantic fictional freedom of the past. People say, for instance, the past was not free either. They had taboos. We have technology. Certainly, Ellul says, we may only have changed the taboos of the past for the techniques of today, but both are at the expense of human freedom. And Ellul refuses, in many of his books, to give cheap remedies, because he believes that searching diagnosis must come first. If, for example, technological society can make art innocuous and religion just an escape, and turn principles into propaganda, then if we merely answer technology by technology, we'll only tighten the screw further.